This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'm Maureen Corrigan, and I have the pleasure of interviewing Elizabeth Alexander tonight. Elizabeth Alexander is one of our most distinguished and one of our most well-known poets. In 2009, she delivered a poem that she had written for President Obama's first inauguration. That poem, yes, that poem, Praise Song for the Day, was heard and discussed all over the world. She has written 6 books of poetry, including American Sublime, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer. And she's the author of 2 collections of critical essays. Elizabeth Alexander currently teaches at Yale, where she's the Thomas E. Donnelly Professor of African American Studies. I can also tell you that in addition to being a highly recognized and gifted poet, Elizabeth Alexander is a lot of fun. I first met her in February, when she and I were both in Asheville, North Carolina, at a conference of publishers and small bookstore owners, independent bookstore owners. It was a cold and dark and icy night in Asheville. And I walked into the restaurant where, you know, a few of the independent bookstore owners and publishers were gathering for dinner. And there was Elizabeth Alexander. And she looked up at me, and she smiled her 500-watt smile, which you will see tonight. And I said to myself, I want to be friends with that woman. And what happened was, for the next 2 days, when we saw each other and when we could, we'd talk about books. We'd talk about our shared experience, although at different times, of being in the PhD program at the University of Pennsylvania. And we would talk about being the mothers of teenagers. That we talked about a lot. So not surprisingly, our friendship ended with a drink, still talking about teenagers. But we had gin gimlets at the bar of the Grove Park Inn on the last night of the conference to toast F. Scott Fitzgerald, who spent time at the Grove Park Inn, probably at the saddest time of his life. It was a thrill for me, I can tell you, to toast one of our greatest American writers with one of our greatest living American poets. That was quite a night for me. Elizabeth was at that conference because her memoir, The Light of the World, was about to be published. Her memoir, of course, deals with the tragic death of her husband, Ficre Ghebreyesus, in 2012, a few days after his surprise 50th birthday party. The memoir is beautiful, it's meditative, it's intense, and it's illuminating. Elizabeth is talking about the struggle of dealing with a traumatic event like this that rips a hole in your world, and somehow trying to come to terms with it without relying on prepackaged formulations such as the one I just used, or without the structure of organized religion. About Ficre, who was a painter, Elizabeth wrote, "To live with a painter is to marvel at the space between the things they see that you cannot see." I think the same can be said of reading this memoir. You marvel at the space between what a poet like Elizabeth sees and what the rest of us can't see without her guidance. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Elizabeth Alexander.
Thank you. Well, that was a beautiful introduction, and I am very appreciative, and appreciative even more for the friendship and what it means to come together because of our commitment to words, this strange life we have where we go around and talk about words and teach words and share words and believe in the power of words. So it is a wonderful thing to make a new friend that way. I'm very happy to be here in Santa Fe in New Mexico. I'm very happy, among other things, to be. I understand there's some young people here from the New Mexico School of the Arts. Where would you be? What, make your noise. Be teenagers. Where are you? Okay, there you are. Well, I'm very, very happy you're here. That makes me feel like somehow my kids are here with me, too. They are almost 17 and or almost 16 and 17. So I'm going to use most of my time tonight before Maureen and I have our conversation to read from The Light of the World, to read from the memoir. But I was kindly reminded that tonight is about all of my work, and so I want to start with a poem, and I want to also thank you all and your teachers for studying some of my poetry. And I'll start by reading Praise Song for the Day. When I was asked by President Obama, President-elect at the time, Obama, to write a poem for his inaugural, I wrote very much to the moment, hoping that I was writing something that would be enduring, but writing at a moment into which so much was encompassed, into which so much hope was funneled. And I like to read it every now and again. I don't read it very often at all anymore, but to see how it lives in different places. And I realize that I still believe and hope for what I said. Praise Song for the Day. Each day we go about our business, walking past each other, catching each other's eyes or not, about to speak or speaking. All about us is noise. All about us is noise and bramble, thorn and din, each one of our ancestors on our tongues. Someone is stitching up a hem, darning a hole in a uniform, patching a tire, repairing the things in need of repair. Someone is trying to make music somewhere with a pair of wooden spoons on an oil drum, with cello, boombox, harmonica, voice. A woman and her son wait for the bus. A farmer considers the changing sky. A teacher says, "Take out your pencils. Begin." We encounter each other in words, words spiny or smooth, whispered or declaimed, words to consider, reconsider. We cross dirt roads and highways that mark the will of someone and then others who said, "I need to see what's on the other side. I know there's something better down the road. We need to find a place where we are safe." We walk into that which we cannot yet see. Say it plain that many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, built brick by brick the glittering edifices they would then keep clean and work inside of. Praise song for struggle, praise song for the day. Praise song for every hand-lettered sign, the figuring it out at kitchen tables. Some live by love thy neighbor as thyself. Others by first do no harm or take no more than you need. What if the mightiest word is love? Love beyond marital, filial, national. Love that casts a widening pool of light. Love with no need to preempt grievance. In today's sharp sparkle, this winter air, anything can be made, any sentence begun. On the brim, on the brink, on the cusp. Praise song for walking forward in that light. So I never imagined that I would write a memoir. I have written nonfiction. I write about literature and culture. I've written short stories. I mostly write poetry. And I love the form of the essay, actually, as well. But I'm a poet. That's who I am. There was something about memoir. I love to read them, but I imagined that that was somehow too revealing, too much, to use my grandmother's phrase, putting your business and our business in the street. And so I didn't think that that was anything I wanted to do. Of course, you know, my poetry puts all my business in the street, but the artifice of it, the beautiful screen that you make, the vessel that you make for the thoughts and the emotions and the words and the feelings and the images to live inside of, makes you think for a moment that it's not really you and you can send it out there. But of course, it's all us. But what took me to this form was when the earth was felt as if it was pulled out from under, as Maureen Corrigan told you, three and a half years ago, my husband, my children's father, the most beautiful soul I ever knew, the most beautiful soul most people who knew him ever knew, completely unexpectedly in our home, died of cardiac arrest. So that should be said first. And in the moving forward, in the trying to literally feel the earth beneath me when it felt like it was no longer beneath me, I put my hand on the desk on a piece of paper with a pen or a pencil in it, and I wrote words in order not to know what I was feeling, but to know what was happening. I didn't narrate what was happening. I just wrote words. I wrote phrases. I made sounds. And I learned at the end of that first stage that writing was my companion, that art is our companion as we move through the most unimaginable things in this life. But I didn't think it would become anything that was public, that I would make that choice. It was when my very, very beloved editor said to me, "Are you writing? I think you have something. I think you should make something." That I said, well, maybe I am, and let's just see. Checking at every stage, was this something to share? How did my children feel about it? But also seeing the absolute necessity of making this book. This is a book of prose that's a poet's book. This is a book that, as poetry is written, sound by sound, musically, phrase by phrase, word by word, not knowing when you start out where the end of the road is, not knowing, to go back to Praise Song for the Day, what's on the other side, but knowing that you need to see what's on the other side, that propulsion is what took me through the writing of this book in the same way and from the same place that my poems come from. And that was a tremendously liberating thing in trying on a whole new art form at such an extreme point in life. That was the grounding. And what we also know in poetry is we have very, very powerful belief in the elliptical leap. By which I mean, in poems, we don't feel that we need to say A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, a poem is like A, M, X, B, B again, that sounded good, R. I think that that kind of logic, which is simply how my brain is put together, when I realized that that kind of logic could also be prose logic, that there could be leaps, that I could write in very, very condensed, small, small chapters with all of the economy that I strive to perfect in poetry, that was another way that I found and felt that I could do it. So there are leaps in time. I think that even as we move forward on a timeline, the past comes in. I think we all experience that. That's not related, I don't think, to tragedy. So you'll see that there are all kinds of leaps, and that at the end of the day, though occasioned by unimaginable loss, it's a book about love and gratitude. The story seems to begin with catastrophe, but in fact began earlier and is not a tragedy, but rather a love story. Perhaps tragedies are only tragedies in the presence of love, which confers meaning to loss. Loss is not felt in the absence of love. The queen died and then the king died is a plot, wrote E.M. Forster in The Art of the Novel. But the queen died and then the king died of grief is a story. It begins on a beautiful April morning when a man wakes exhausted and returns to sleep in his beloved 13-year-old son's trundle bed, declaring, "This is the most comfortable bed I have ever slept in." Or it begins when the wife says goodbye to the man a few hours later, walking in front of his car, switching her hips a bit, a blown kiss as she heads to her office and he continues on to his painting studio. Or the story begins as he packs a tote bag with the usual. The tote is astral blue and printed with Giotto angels, off to his studio for a day of painting, then home, as if nothing extraordinary has happened when in fact he has been envisioning worlds, hanging the Giotto bag on a hook in the mudroom and changing out of his paint-splattered jeans into gym shorts and a t-shirt for yoga in the family room or a run on the treadmill in the basement. Soon, the two children will walk down Edge Hill Road from the bus stop like burros under their knapsacks, and his wife will prepare dinner while listening to Thelonious Monk's evocative open intervals and sipping from a glass of white wine that he's opened and poured for her. "My frosty white?" she'd ask a few times a week, and he'd chuckle and say, "Right away, my love, chop, chop." They enjoyed playing and acting out boy-girl courtliness. The 13-year-old does his homework, and the 12-year-old practices his drumming. The man's home life is the unchanging, beautiful same, so anything could occur in the painting studio each day. I am the wife. I am the wife of 15 years. I am the plumpish wife, the pretty wife, the loving wife, the smart wife, the American wife. I am eternally his wife. Perhaps the story begins with the 36 lottery tickets he bought 2 days before he died, which I discovered weeks later when they fluttered out of the pages of one of the many books he was reading. Or it begins with his surprise 50th birthday party 4 days before he died and the spoken tributes from his loved ones and strawberries and pancakes and music the next morning. Or it began when I met him 16 years before. That was always a good story, an actual coup de foudre, a bolt of lightning, love at first sight. I felt a visceral torque, I would tell people, a literal churn of my organs, not butterflies, not arousal, rather a not unpleasant rotation of my innards as never before. Lightning struck and did not curdle the cream, but instead turned it to sweet, silken butter. Lightning turned sand into glass. The story began in the winter of 1961 when two quietly mighty women were each pregnant, one in Asmara, Eritrea, the other in Harlem, USA, one with her sixth child, one with her first. The East African sun would arrive on March 21, 1962, the most hallowed day of the zodiac. It is the beginning and the end of the astrological calendar, and so it is said that children born on March 21st are ancient souls who possess the wonder and innocence of newborns. The American child, a girl, would come on May 30th into the chatter and buzz of Gemini in Gotham. The story begins on a Thursday night. I bring an unexpected guest home to stay with us, an artist friend who'd spoken on campus that afternoon. When I take her to her hotel after dinner, we find it is in a deserted corner of town, far off the beaten track, so I offer to bring her to sleep in our guest room. She accepts with relief, and I call Fikre to let him know that company is coming. When Lorna and I arrive home 10 minutes later, the house is lit and glowing. The kettle is hot, and tea is brewing in the black Japanese cast iron pot. Fikre has put raw almonds in a small celadon bowl. It is late. The boys are sleeping. We are so pleased to live like this, organized and open and welcome when friends pass through, and we can bring them to Hamden, the hamlet adjacent to New Haven, where we recently moved to live in a tan stucco arts and crafts style house surrounded by a magic garden. Hamden, my first suburb, albeit a very urban one, Hamden, where Fikre fell in love with property that reminded him of the African compound where he grew up amidst flowers, inside walls his mother painted apricot, spring sky blue, rose violet, and butter yellow. The next morning, I organize the children for school and send them off, and Fikre makes coffee when our friend rises shortly after. We three drink our cappuccinos under the gazebo, which he'd painted in the delicate colors of the remembered borders of his mother's gauzy dresses and shawls. Some might take the colors for straightforward pastels or Monet water lilies, but they came from Africa and from his mother. Hanging inside the gazebo is a mobile he fashioned from some slender, twisty branches that blew down in the yard after a storm. The mobile turns gently in the breeze. The morning is gray, and the yard smells of the fresh, damp earth of early spring. As we walk toward the house, something makes us look back into the yard over our shoulders. There is a giant hawk sitting on the branch of our 100-year-old oak tree, eviscerating and devouring a squirrel. We freeze to watch. The raptor is utterly focused on its task. I watch Fikre and Lorna scrutinizing, their artist's eyes recording what they see. The hawk attends to its business undisturbed. It is rapacious. It takes what it wants. The bloody ribbons of the squirrel's entrails hang off the branch as the hawk eats the entire remains of the hapless rodent in about 5 minutes. Fikre tells us he has seen the bird the day before with the children and shows us a short video he took on his phone of the creature on the same branch, eating another squirrel. I have seen a hawk a few times, but never one so intent on its survival. Never seen predation itself up close and in action. It is pure and elemental, necessarily violent, riveting nature itself. We watch for as long as we can before we have to go off to the duties of our days. Some weeks later on his bureau, I find an acrostic Fikre made, which exhausted variations on the word hawk. He'd assign numbers to the letters and then assign those numbers to lottery tickets, which I later discover he bought by the dozens and secreted in the pages of the books he was reading. Henry Ford believed the soul of a person is located in their last breath and so captured the last breath of his best friend, Thomas Edison, in a test tube and kept it evermore. It is on display at the Henry Ford Museum outside Detroit, like Galileo's finger in the Church of Santa Croce. But Edison's last breath is an invisible relic. Fikre breathed his last breath into me when I opened his mouth and breathed everything I had into him. He felt like a living person then. I am certain his soul was there. And then, in the ambulance, riding the long ride down to the hospital, even as they worked and worked, the first icy wind blew into me. He was going or gone. "I need to call somebody, don't I?" I asked the ambulance driver, a woman. "Yes, you do," she said. Black men die more catastrophically across class than anybody else in America. Toni Morrison, "Not a house in this country ain't packed to its rafters with some dead Negro's grief." He was an African man, an Eritrean man, and an African American man. He was a black man. He was not the descendant of slaves. He literally walked across his country through killing fields to escape when he was 16 years old. He walked into the dust of Khartoum. He was a refugee in Sudan, in Italy, in Germany, and in the United States, where he would end up living in New Haven, Connecticut, for far longer than he had ever lived anywhere. He washed dishes in Italy, attended school before he knew a word of the language in a Germany so racially hostile it almost broke him. He went years without seeing his parents. His parents and his community built him to survive, but it was not without price. His big heart burst. The autopsy later tells us his arteries were blocked nearly completely, despite the fact that he was slim and energetic and ate yogurt and blueberries and flaxseed, despite the fact that he passed stress tests with flying colors. I learned that severe heart disease is first discovered in one of five sufferers when they drop dead. He could never quit smoking, though he tried and tried over and over. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. He was probably dead before he hit the ground, the emergency room doctor and the coroner and a cardiologist I later speak with tell me. That is why there was no blood on the floor, despite his head wound. He might have felt strange, the doctors told me, before what they call the cardiac event, but not for more than a flash. One doctor tells me he is certain that Fikre saw my face as he died. We are meant to take comfort in that knowledge, if knowledge it is. Because he was eminently strong of body and spirit, he went to the grocery store despite fatigue and bought supplies to make the Easter bolognese. It was a busy week ahead, and Monday was the night to shop and prep. I pushed him like an Italian wife, as I always did, vai, vai, vai. And so he went to the store in preparation for his sauce and started the cooking. His last night on earth, I was out of the house, showing films to my students for class. who could have known, but still, I look back and wish I had known, and that we could have stayed up all night together, entwined, saying every single thing to each other and weeping. Like a man waiting for his execution, I think, a maudlin thought, but my fervent, despairing current wish is that we had every single moment, that I could have braved the countdown with him, that we could have walked the gangplank together. But where would the children have been during this anguished, operatic exit? I could never allow that particular howling agony to touch them. For them, I prefer no clue, no lead-up, no mortal dread. If I go back to that late afternoon, I walk down the sparkling block, and as I came up to the house, the boy, my boy, came running to greet me. I can freeze the moment before we knew, before Simon ran through the basement door and found his father on the floor. We three found him there on the floor. The big boy, named for the wise king, knew his father was dead. It never occurred to me he could be dead. The younger boy's thoughts were all magic. If I had gone to check him, Simon said, they'll bring him back. I breathed into his mouth. He was supple. The 911 operator asked if my husband was breathing, and I could not say. The air around him was warm and vaporous. How many times that day, and in following weeks and months, did I say, my husband? My husband died unexpectedly. I just lost my husband. Lost implies we are looking. He might be found. I lost my husband. Where is he, I often wonder. As I set out on some small adventure, some new place, somewhere he does not know, I think I must call him, think I must tell him, think what would he think what he thinks, know what he thinks. When I held him in the basement, he was himself, Fikre. When I held him in the hospital as they worked and cut off his clothes, he was himself. When they cleaned his body and brought his body for us to say goodbye, he had left his body, though it still belonged to us. His body was colder than it had been, though not ice cold, nor stiff, nor hard. His spirit had clearly left, as it had not left when we found him on the basement floor, and I knew that he could hear us. Now I know for sure the soul is an evanescent thing, and the body is its temporary container, because I saw it. I saw the body with the soul in it, I saw the body with the soul leaving, and I saw the body with the soul gone. We courted over 6 weeks in the summer of 1996. At the end of the first week, we decided to marry, but told no one. They'll think we're crazy, we said. It's our secret, we were certain. We ate little, drank sweet cafecitos, and listened to Ahmad Jamal, Betty Carter, Abby Lincoln, Randy Weston, and Don Pullen. Geniuses of the African diaspora, we both celebrated. We wrote dozens of haikus back and forth in a shared notebook, and he nicknamed himself Basho in Africa. Basho wrote in the 17th century in Japan's Edo period and was thought to be the greatest practitioner of haiku, but he is even more renowned for leading others in renku, a collaborative linked verse poetry. No one had ever asked me to write poems together. How I researched Tiny Eritrea when I first met him. How I practiced saying his name correctly, Fikre Gebreyesus, Fikre Gebreyesus, playing his first answering machine message back over and over again to get it right. How I opened myself to learning this brand new person from a brand new, fascinating place. I came from the pig people, and he came from the cow and the sheep people. Some of my people were Midland slaves who made something from nothing and Massa's leavings. Some of my people were fancy and free. He came from forever free Christian Coptic Highlanders who alternate seasons of harvest bounty and Lenten veganism. That was the interesting idea of us. East and West Africa married, descendants of slaves who survived, descendants of free people of color, descendants of freedom fighters never enslaved, the strongest of all to be conjoined in our children. Sometimes we talked about this. But mostly we just talked, the deepest thoughts, the sweetest thoughts, the questions we had waited to ask forever. He was a bottomless boat, and the boat that would always hold me. I returned to Chicago to my job, but we had pledged our troth. All we had to do was get through the teaching year, and then I would move, and we would be together. He had not yet met my parents, but my father said, I know you, and I see how you are now that you are with him, so I know this man is right. He came to visit in Chicago and met my chosen family there. He cooked a feast for my people and teenage children, and Muna and Bernadine, the group's elder sisters to me, telephoned my parents on the spot and had a very serious conversation with them. Yes, they'd met the man. This is why he is good. This is how he loves her. How did my life become so African? I whispered to Fikre with a smile as we watched the modern-day village elders bless our union. Soon after, we went to Washington to my parents, and after talking with him about history for hours after breakfast, my mother pronounced, "I have known him all my life." He spoke to me often about the wide skies he grew up beneath in Eritrea and the red rocks in the highlands. It sounded like what I had heard about the American Southwest, so I planned a trip for us. We went to Albuquerque and Santa Fe, drove the high road to Taos, ate fresh tortillas, and saw the blood-stained walls of the Church of the Penitents, followed a black hawk down a river for dozens of miles, and sat on boulders in the cool, fresh air, tilting our faces to the impossibly bright sunshine, soaking in its pure energy. Everywhere we went, fleece from cottonwood trees swirled around us like a conjurer's transformative wind. We lived out of time for 2 weeks. The advent of the Hale-Bopp comet was imminent. We felt we were chasing it, or it was chasing us. In Ojo Caliente, a hot spring in northern New Mexico, we watched stars streak across the sky, the moon evaporate into eclipse, all gone save a bright white sliver and red Mars. We watched from a lithium spring, arsenic bath, iron tub, salty water steamed from the ground. In the lounge, we watched our first TV in days and saw that people from a strange cult called Heaven's Gate interpreted in the same comet a doomsday directive and so ate poison in applesauce, drank vodka, and died. They believed they were going to the spaceship. When we kissed, we tasted minerals on each other's lips. We ate peach pie on the wraparound porch. We saw a total lunar eclipse in Sedona. Somewhere there is a picture of us that we asked a stranger to take as we watched the sunset from a hillside in a crowd of hundreds, and everyone clapped when the burning orb dropped out of view. In Havasupai, we hiked the 10 miles down to the reservation. You could hear the waterfall before you saw it. Brilliant colored water flowers abounded. You could also hear reggae. The gospel of Bob Marley played everywhere. The Indians respected Fikre because he was an African, an ancient man. He drove 2,000 miles. He prided himself on being a road warrior. One night we drove across an infinite field under the stars and heard Navajo on the radio, and then someone speaking to Jesus, and then sounds from the spaceship. I found a bit that Fikre wrote about that trip, and for some reason he wrote it in Spanish. It begins, "Éramos dos." We were two, the last two people left on Earth. Two days after the funeral, it was Easter, and Cindy drove down from Boston with all the fixings for Easter dinner, including a ham. "We have to have Easter," she said. I watched her slim fingers peeling potatoes and dicing white onion at my kitchen table with my mother. This is how we do. A few weeks later, Robin brings another whole ham, wrapped up in heavy-duty aluminum foil in a roller bag on Metro North. When she arrives, she starts the oven and studs the ham with cloves and, yes, pineapple rings. We sit and talk quietly as the house begins to smell like a million Negro homes across the miles and the years. "Eat something, baby," she said, "some ham on a homemade cloverleaf roll. Please, baby, eat just a bit." Fikre loved the cri de coeur from August Wilson's play, Two Trains Running, "I want my ham." He called those plays so African, the way Wilson's communities absorb their eccentrics and make space for them, without explanation. Once on a trip to St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, we went to visit an artist friend of my parents who made tie-dyed fabric and dresses. We sat in her atelier on a Saturday afternoon as folks wandered in and out, soliloquized, and left. The preacher, the hustler, the wino, the diva all came in without announcement, said their piece, and exited stage right. "It's so African," said Fikre, in love with the quotidian theater. "It's like Africa, and it's like an August Wilson play." Do you see why I miss him? I call out to no one. Will I remember everything? What am I meant to keep? Fikre is not here. to tell me what kind of trees my parents are, but I know they are mighty trees. They do not yield to the wind. They go straight up, unbending. Redwood seems too regionally imprecise. We are definitely not Westerners. I think of my parents as having many colors ranging from the new greens of spring to autumn golds, but they have the constancy of perennials. All shelter and trunk to lean on, my parents stand like trees and survey everything. I am always their child, and yet it is not as when I was a child, because I am also mother to Solomon and Simon, for whom I must be a tree. Fikre planted trees for me that were lush and romantic, magnolia, Japanese maple, for those were the years of amorous love and its fulsome expressions which sustain us through the winter months of marriage. Now I need to be, like my parents, the 100-year-old oak in our backyard that lives even after hammocks and tire swings have been nailed in and taken down, and after the Southern Connecticut tornado of 1989 destroyed wide swaths of Hamden as the wind tore down the streets uprooting trees. Our 100-year-old tree stood as my parents stand, as they saw elders stand, as ancestors stood. During the funeral and the months after, they come back and forth from Washington. My mother roasts chickens and sets tables, and my father gets in the car and buys groceries and non-essential electronic appliances. Never once do they allow their grief to supersede even a corner of our home, and yet it comes over me like another enormous dark cloud. They have lost a son. They have lost a son. They do not cry in front of me until I am much, much stronger. Then it is first my father who weeps. To be a parent is to be terra firma. To stand is to be planted in the earth. Fikre was meant to be an elder, but his days were not long. He who believes in the lottery, he who did not leave a large carbon footprint, he who never met a child he didn't enchant, he who loved to wear the color pink, he whose children made him laugh until he cried, he who never told a lie, he who majored in physics, who knew the laws of the universe, he who wanted to win the lottery for me. What does it mean to grieve in the absence of religious culture? I am formally Episcopalian on both sides, an Afro-Saxon, but was not raised going to church. We exist, I would like to say, Afro-Saxons. There are a few of us. I'm of the joyful variety. I'm not of the dour variety of Afro-Saxon, but we work very hard. But I was not raised going to church, though I spent much of my life until going to college studying ballet and modern dance at a studio in St. Mark's Church, performing with the company in services. Art is certainly my religion. I believe in the chosen family, especially as I get older. I believe in some kind of encompassing black culture that I am part of, syncretic, to use the word Fikre liked. But I am also aware of the romance behind that sense of belonging. I am feeling very Jewish, I keep hearing in my head, thinking not of my actual Jewish Jamaican great-grandfather, but rather about a wish for a religious culture that reveres the word and tells you what to do. Rosh Hashanah, days of awe, invite the dead to Sukkot. There seems to be a poetic ritual for everything. I am not a black Baptist who will fall out in her grief and be lifted by the hands of her fellow parishioners. I am not an Eritrean woman who goes through the house keening, Fikre Hawe, which means, Fikre, where are you? But I want rules. I want the prayers to say every day for a year at dusk, and I want them to be beautiful and meaningful. I want to sit Shiva and have the neighbors come at the end of the week and walk my family around the block to usher us into the sunlight. Where is the village, I remember thinking when I had my first child. Where is my sister? As I struggled to breastfeed, for I have no blood sisters, and my mother was of the generation for whom baby formula was a miracle of nascent women's lib. My mother-in-law showed me, kind of, though we had no common language, we did have the common language of motherhood and its many acts. Yet I was not lonely without the village, without sisters who were also mothers, because I had Fikre. I hope you're not turning all Christian, Simon says, when he comes home and finds me uncharacteristically blaring gospel music. I am not, but I am listening to Mahalia Jackson in a whole new way. How I got over. My soul looks back in wonder. I hear for the very first time. The gratitude in that song is what washes over me. The word thank, repeated over and over. My soul does indeed look back in wonder. I had Fikre. I have Fikre. I have these extraordinary children. I have a village. I have an art form. I am black. We are African. We come from survivors and doers. My parents are wise and strong. My body is strong. I was loved without bound or condition. I exist in time and in context, not floating in space. My troubles are small compared to some. My troubles are not eternal. My days are not through. How I Got Over was one of Dr. King's favorite songs, and Miss Jackson sang it just before the March on Washington, along with I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned. She spurred him on when he briefly stumbled as he gave that mighty speech. Tell them about the dream, Martin. And her voice held millions of people aloft. Who we are as a people and how we make our way through sorrows that feel so profoundly intimate and personal, but in fact exist on larger continuums, is what I hear in the song today. The first time she sings How I Got Over It is a question. How did I survive? But after that, the phrase is an answer sung in varied inflection and redolent of varied meanings. This is how. This is how. About halfway through the song, Mahalia Jackson is stirred to clap and stomp, the song now fully in her body, carrying her over to shores unknown. And then the song moves to astonishment. How I got over. In the absence of organized religion, faith abounds in the form of song and art and food and strong arms. When you become a family, you make common culture. Fikre and I shared cultures folded into each other and quickly made an indelible family culture. That we grew up around the world from each other seemed totally irrelevant. When he sleep-talked in Tigrinya, I remembered sometimes. I remembered that our entire relationship and most of his days took place in his fourth language. It is genuinely shocking to be jolted out of the world of our common culture into the world of our different worlds and rituals around death and dying. He is no longer here as the ultimate medium or translator, the one who selected what mattered. There is only one unalloyed culture and no one to negotiate the treaties. And the strange awareness that there was any culture other than our own. From Langston Hughes, I loved my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends. Soft as it began, I loved my friend. I look across at his side of the bed as I wake with my mind racing with quandaries, and I think I miss my friend, plain and simple. The boys and I go to Robert and Michelle's for dinner. They are among the many dear people who have been feeding us. They've previously dropped off lentil soup, meatloaf, and Robert's gravlax, but now we feel we can make and keep a date and spend an evening with people who will hold us tenderly. Michelle was another one of Fikre's Italian-American sisters. They would cook for each other and speak Italian in the kitchen, discuss the nuances of spinach with currants and pine nuts, and the relative merits of pasta shapes, orecchiette versus cresti di gallo, rigatoni versus penne. Tonight she makes spaghetti with 100 onions, the most comforting and delicious dish I have ever eaten, which we slurp as though we've never been fed before, and talk about Fikre. I love him, Robert says. Not I loved him. He is my friend. I can still talk to him. Yes, I think that is true exactly. But the friendship part of marriage, that is the part that is enacted, that is the part for which you need the person present, and that is what I miss. Robert and Michelle are long marrieds and understand this absolutely. Yes, I still talk to him. Yes, if I still myself enough, I can imagine what he would say to guide me. But that is not the same as friendship itself. And friendship in marriage is its own thing. Friendship in a cup of tea or a glass of wine or a cappuccino every Sunday morning. Friendship in buying undershirts and underpants. Friendship in picking up a prescription or rescuing the towed car. Friendship in waiting for the phone call after the mammogram. Friendship in toast butter just so. Friendship in butter in shoveling the snow. I am the one you want to tell. You are the one I want to tell. Days later, it feels like progress when I write to Michelle for the spaghetti recipes. Recipe. And she replies, "Are we the only ones who crave this? I came home and made it tonight, and we blissed out. Okay, here's how to make it." And there's the recipe. "This is the best dish. It'll make you want to throw rocks at other pasta dishes." As I make the pasta, I remember Fikre in our kitchen teaching me how to more adeptly use a knife, to preheat a pan, to press garlic cloves so the paper jackets slip off, to simmer tomatoes until they turn sweet and roast beets until they are like candy. The boys and I eat our delicious spaghetti until sated. Our whole body is warm. Fikre is in our stomachs. We loved Jimmy Scott's version of the David Byrne song Heaven. Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. These days, I picture heaven populated by the umber angels Fikre painted in abundance, but that seems too fanciful. I never truly believed in heaven and cannot manufacture it. Little Jimmy Scott's plaintiveness seems right when he sings, "Nothing ever happens." How better to describe the infinite solitude of the afterlife? "When this kiss is over, it will start again. It will not be any different. It will be exactly the same," he sings. "Each kiss is fixed. It is the same long kiss, but it will never change. That is the comfort, and that is the heartbreak." One night at bedtime, Simon asks if I want to come with him to visit Fikre in heaven. "Yes," I say, and lie down on his bed. "First you close your eyes," he said, "and ride the clear glass elevator. Up we go." "What do you see?" I ask. "God is sitting at the gate," he answers. "What does God look like?" I ask. "Like God, Mama," he says. "Now we go to where Daddy is." He has two rooms, Simon says, one room with a single bed and his books, and another where he paints. The painting room is vast. He can look out any window he wants and paint. That room has four views: our backyard, the dock he painted in Maine, Asmara, and New Mexico. "New Mexico," I ask. "Yes," Simon says, "the volcano crater with the magic grass." "Ah, yes," I say, "the caldera, where we saw the gophers and the jackrabbits and the elk running across, and Daddy called it the veldt." "Yes, do you see it?" And I do. The light is perfect for painting. His bed in heaven is a single bed. "Okay, it's time to go now," Simon says, so down we go. "You can come with me anytime," he says. "Thank you, my darling." "I don't think you can find it by yourself," he says, "but one day you will." Last night, I went into a bookstore for the first time since Fikre died. Ah, I thought I have been avoiding this, for he is the ghost of all bookstores. He is in the history section or the art section or the gardening section, reading books and piling them up. He would gather books for the children's library, more books that they could ever read, more books than I thought would interest them, and we would fuss about it. I'd suggest taking a few off the pile. He'd say, "That makes the whole design fall apart." I'd say, "Where will we put them?" He'd say, "We'll get a bigger house." And then we'd laugh. "My darling, you are not in this bookstore. Carrying home a bag of books, I think of all the books I will never know about because you will not show them to me. I think of the loss of knowledge, all the things I will never know because you are not here to tell me. I cannot ask questions. I cannot be reminded. I can no longer say, though I still do, to the children, that's a daddy question, when they ask about the Peloponnesian War or the Khmer Rouge or Latin declension or the quadratic formula or how sinkholes are formed on limestone beds. You, of all knowledge, you of all curiosity, God of books and deep knowing, enemy of facile pronouncements, Fikre Ghebreyesus, ghost of all bookstores." And so the story ends or pauses, for as we know, it is all one long story. My sons and I have moved to New York City. Today, we look out our window at the Hudson River and wait for another hurricane as the sky turns lavender and orange, Fikre colors. When the rain is most dramatic, we feel him close. The boys grow taller than everyone around them and become young men. Their grandfather turns 80, and with my mother, they circle the wagons and leave their home of 42 years in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, and return to New York, their ancestral metropolis, to be extended family with us, as Fikre always wanted it. New York is the place that called Fikre as well, a place with mythos, a place where everyone belongs. Now, I live in a neighborhood of stage doors and students walking down the street with huge instrument cases. The dancers pirouette on Lincoln Center Plaza and clatter down the street in high fabulosity. They are the children making art. Fikre was one of the children at the Art Students League, but he was never a child and always a child. That rare combination, true to his position on the Zodiac, ancient and brand new, as anyone who knew him would say. I am in New York City, where I was born, where I have spent decades trying to return. Welcome home, I am told many times, even by people who do not know I was born in Harlem, USA, at 135th and 5th, in the Riverton Apartments, at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, where my father was born. Fikre and I never made it here together. That was planned for when the children graduated from high school. Death sits in the comfortable chair in the corner of my new bedroom, smoking a cigarette. It is a he, sinuous and sleek, wearing a felt-brimmed hat. He is there when I wake in the middle of the night, sitting quietly, his smoke a visible curl in the New York lights that come in between the Venetian blind slats. At first, I am startled to see him. He sits so near, is so at home. But he doesn't move toward me. He simply cohabits. And so eventually I return to sleep. He isn't going anywhere, but he isn't going to take me either. In the morning, the chair is empty. Which is stronger, death sitting in the corner or life in New York City? Death or my teenage sons sleeping profoundly in the next room, growing overnight? I love plans, my new friend Esther exults, and so do I, for nowadays I feel like plans are all that stands between me and the end of my life. I'm not going to die overnight because next Wednesday I am going with Esther to see an auction of 19th century American documents at Swan Galleries. I'm not going to die tonight because I already took the chicken out of the freezer, and Simon loves roast chicken and rice for dinner, and I promised him I would make it. I'm not going to die tonight because on Saturday, Farah and I are bundling up and going for a walk against the blustery winds along the river to continue the conversation we began almost 30 years ago when we were both in graduate school, before I even knew my beloved Fikre. In New York, I feel joy overwhelming and this same gratitude, for Fikre brought me here, I am sure of it, as sure as if he whispered in my ear, "Go, Lizzie, you are so much braver than you realize. Take our children and go." What are the odds, we used to say, what are the odds that we would end up in the same place and fall in love? Once upon a time, halfway around the world, two women were pregnant at the same time in very different places, and their children grew up and found each other. It happens every day. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was beautiful. It was so powerful to hear you read those passages that I've had in my head ever since reading the memoir the first time. You know, one of the questions that you ask, and you asked it to the audience tonight, is, do you see why I love him? Can you see why I miss him? Mm. And I've felt as a reader, ever since I first read the memoir, absolutely. Absolutely, I see. And I think one of the triumphs of the memoir is that you make me, as a person who never knew Fikre, regret that I never knew him, feel like that's a loss. I also feel like you struggle in the memoir, and you gave the audience a sense of that as well. Do I start here? Do I start with the birth? Both of our mothers were pregnant at the same time. Do I start with the horrible day on which he died? Where do I start? And I would like to ask you to go back and start at that meeting when your innards turned.
Yes.
And tell everybody a little bit more about that meeting, because you have to have had one of the most romantic meetings I've ever read.
Well, it was, and I'll answer all of those wonderful pieces. Mm-hmm. And maybe first with the challenge of writing a character, you know, writing a character who would be believable and compelling to other other people. Many people have said to me how much they loved him. Mm-hmm. But yet, of course, the big danger, what I didn't want to do was like, you know, oh, my husband, he's so cute, he's so smart, he cooks good. You know, yeah. I mean, like, you can't, that's not interesting at all. Yeah. So how to really write that. And I had an interesting conversation. We were speaking about the Brooklyn Book Festival with Mark Doty, the great poet and great memoirist. And I think his book, Heaven's Gate, about losing his partner to AIDS is really one of the great memoirs of widowhood. And so he said, well, in the writing, don't you fall in love all over again? And that's in a way almost necessary to what it means to be able to write it so well that other people can feel it.
Yeah.
That where to begin and to the final part of your question, it really was I didn't read the part where I talk about, you know, having made a number of romantic missteps.
Oh, no.
But, of course, you know, I was a grown-up woman, and I had made a number of romantic missteps, which I think is important to say because we do and because it's part of living, and it is part of the way by which you know if someone is for you. Romance starts in all sorts of different ways, but I know for me, certainly, the ease and immediacy that was not just about, you know, I mean, I would think that a guy was cute every hour, but it wasn't that. This was something profounder, and I knew how to recognize it because I knew how to distinguish it comparatively from other things, and then trust it and believe in it and then invest in it. And so I luckily, he was at a point in his life as well where what we both wanted to do was come together and make family. So there were not those contrasts, though there were logistics about living halfway across the country from each other that we simply figured out. And
you kind of got picked up in a cafe.
I kind of did. I knew a little bit about him.
Yeah.
He and his brothers, has always been a painter, but he also was a great chef. And he and his brothers had a wonderful restaurant, Café Adulis, that was a beautiful, legendary place in New Haven for many, many years. And one of the things that I've loved about going on book tour, I feel like there are enough people that I could try it here. And there's one person who can't answer because I know I know someone's been here. But I go many, many, many places, and I say, has anyone ever been to Café Adulis in New Haven? Is this the first night? No. Okay, oh, there's a hand. Is that Mary Nell?
Yeah.
Oh, see, no, you weren't allowed to. Okay, well, I know that person has been there. But okay, this is the one night the trick didn't work. But I go amazing places. Where?
We can.
Yay, excellent. So you ate Ficre's food. And I can't tell you what that means to me and how powerful it is. You know, New Haven, Connecticut is not the center of the universe, though at times it thinks it does when you're on the university's campus. But this was a very special place, and this food was very, very unusual. And nobody knew about Eritrea, this little... And his food wasn't just traditional food. It was kind of Fantasia food. So I say all of that to say that I went to New Haven from Chicago to write a play, and he and his brothers had this restaurant and this cafe, and I knew who they were, and they gave us an opening night party, and I knew they were just this nice family. But then he came to... I was in his cafe, and I was to meet a friend who didn't appear, and I looked up, and there he was, and he said, and this makes those who love me laugh, because they say, oh, this is so you. He said, oh, can we talk about you? He said, can we talk about, I loved your play. Can we talk about your play? So I was like, moi? Yes, why, certainly. Do sit down, garçon. And so, that was really that, and I gave him my Chicago address. I was going back, but I had a little campus apartment for one more week. And when I came home that day, my phone was ringing. And he said, well, maybe you want to come by for coffee. And that was that.
Yeah.
So it was a lovely and magical beginning. So I knew that one of the things that the book, a task it had to do, was, I thought, tell what happened, tell the bad thing first.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought, like, I am the kind of reader who reads ahead to the bad thing and then comes back. And if it is the catalyzing event, and if the book will be described in that way, you know, I just, it's like pull off the Band-Aid, say what happened.
Yeah.
But then, of course, immediately the writerly question becomes, but how do I make anybody care about these people? How do I describe their world? How do I describe them individually? How do I talk about this family? and thus the moving around in time.
Yes, yeah. And you certainly do it through the details. And again, everybody heard it tonight. The food, the paintings, the texture of your days together, it all comes through so clearly. One thing I wondered, I mean, Fikre was a painter. When you met him and he said, "Would you like to see some of my paintings?"
Yeah.
He's living in a loft, and you describe that in detail, that he's got this repurposed wardrobe hanger from Macy's, and that's his closet, Macy's,
yeah,
that closed in New Haven.
Yeah, yeah.
You had earned your PhD. You were already a poet of some renown. Your family was certainly had this stature in Washington, D.C. Your parents were part of the government world in D.C. I wondered if there was any tension when you said, "I've fallen in love with this guy. He's from Eritrea, and he paints." You know, there's a difference in class there, and I wondered about that.
Well, that's interesting. So a lot of things are interesting. There actually was not a difference in class. Mm. There was a difference in history.
Okay.
So his father was a judge. Mm-hmm. He came from a long line of judges and wise people and landed people, mm-hmm, in Eritrea. And then, and I didn't read a lot of this, but there was a decades-long and very, very intense war in Eritrea, between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And everyone, including in his family, you know, he lost a brother. Everyone lost someone. People were made refugees. His father was exiled because of his truthfulness on the stand, mm-hmm, right, because he wouldn't make decisions to suit the dictator Mengistu Haile Mariam. 500,000 people are dead at the end of this. Amnesty International is calling it one of the greatest, you know, humanitarian, mm-hmm, crises. I mean, you know, so that is what interrupts this beautiful, mm-hmm, childhood with people of purpose and righteousness, mm-hmm, and that we had in common, yeah, but not the history.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's also interesting about the sort of generations of, you know, work and struggle and educational attainment in my family is that I feel that it actually clears the way for them to have, yes, a PhD, but also a poet.
Yeah.
I'm the first poet, you know. I'm the first, like, you know, that was an odd thing for me to do, mm-hmm, although so very my mother, you know, to suggest that wouldn't a PhD be nice if I was also going to, you know, be a poet. So I think that I think they didn't, you know, when they understood his heft and all that he was and came from, and he had a kind of integrity,
yeah,
which was what they looked for. They look for honesty and solidity and hard work and, frankly, brilliance,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and health. Mm-hmm. You know, we were surprised by what happened, yeah, but he was a very beautifully robust person.
Mm-hmm.
I think in that very primal way, I do think that even in modern-day life, we have this kind of primal, like, who shall sire my children? Who shall sire, mm-hmm, my grandchildren? Who is strong enough to take care of my daughter? I mean, I think, mm-hmm, there's something that we don't even articulate that's very primal about laying eyes on someone and saying, as my mother did from the first time, my mother is not expressive in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "That is my child." She looked at him and said, "That is my child." I can't even express to you how much, yeah, she's not like that.
Yeah.
So I think there's that sort of primalness that says this is the right thing. And again, just to gesture, they had seen the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, knowing what that, right, is, and I think I did read this out, I think a profound thing that I hope to remember with my own children is that, yes, you judge the person, mm-hmm, who your child chooses, but you know your child. So is your child well or is your child crazy,
yeah,
in this relationship?
Yeah.
And they'd seen me crazy and they knew I was sane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
And he was like, "I'm nice." He was so much nicer to them than,
yeah,
he was so nice to them. I remember one time he said, "Well, so when you're ready and you come and live with us," I was like, we haven't had this conversation. But he was the, yeah, kindest person on,
yeah,
the planet.
Yeah. Well, you write a lot about his paintings, and which, again, I think is a hard thing to do. You're talking about paintings through your language, but you're making them come alive. And in fact, there's The cover of the book is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's one of Ficre's paintings, a solitary boat in red and blue. Mm-hmm. And I love that you read out to the audience that quote, which has stayed with me, that he was the boat that you thought would hold you forever.
Yes. Yes.
And here it is on the cover. But he didn't want to sell his paintings. He didn't want to promote his paintings.
Yeah,
why?
Yeah, you know, and that, I mean, that made me insane.
Yeah, but you've done it here, by
well,
the way,
yeah,
which I thought
now,
was clever.
And people, you know, and he had great ego and sense of self mm-hmm. around his work. He was very serious about his work. He, as a grown-up person, after, you know, a successful restaurateur, applied to and went to the Yale Art School for mm-hmm. his master's degree. He, you know, he was proud to do what he did, but he said that selling, that he was not a schmoozer in any way, shape, yeah. or form, and that's what the art world felt like to him. And so, you know, and he said, I'm supposed to be making these paintings, I'll get there. Mm. And so, you know, my God, I mean, 882 paintings. And now there have been shows, and there will be more shows, and there's interest, and it is happening.
Yeah.
And he did the one thing that only he could do. You know, so.
And he did say at some point,
it will happen after I'm dead.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah, he did. Yeah. And I don't think that was a moment of sort of looking ahead. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I think as someone who came from a culture that was war-torn, mm-hmm. who had seen so much interrupted, you know, one of the stories that I tell in the book that is always one of the most moving stories he ever told me was being, I think he was 12 years old, and he was educated at an Italian, in Eritrea, it was colonized by the Italians for some time. Mm-hmm. So he went to an Italian Jesuit school, and one day the teacher read out his essay in class and didn't say his name and said, Bambini, one among you shall be a great artist. Mm. One among you is a true writer. And that was the proudest moment of his life. And the next day he returned to school and it was chained shut and everyone was gone because the war had moved in such a way that they couldn't stay open safely mm-hmm. anymore. So I think that, you know, when that's what you come up in, mm-hmm. when that is the reality of everyone you love and everyone around you, you know, he lost his admired brother who was, they called them freedom fighters. He himself at 16, the reason he left the country was he went to the front lines mm-hmm. to sign up. And his mother went and took him back and put him out that day. Mm-hmm. And he walked with his cousin to Sudan. I mean, right. So I think that's just to say that sense of doing what you're supposed to be doing, of life being a full and beautiful place, but nothing is permanent.
Yeah.
I think he had a really keen sense of that. And so was grateful to be able simply to have a family, to have these children, and to make his paintings. And to be in his garden.
Yeah.
And to read books. You know, that was all he wanted.
Well, your lives do intersect on that theme of having the ground pulled out from under you.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot in the memoir about how you live with such a tragic loss without that recourse to organized religion, a certain
yeah.
faith. I mean, part of what you read for us tonight,
mm-hmm.
The doctor saying to you he could hear you
mm-hmm.
when he had collapsed, and you say, well, we're meant to take comfort in such knowledge, if knowledge it is.
Mm-hmm.
You write a lot about visions, about mm-hmm. dreams, mm-hmm. about waking visions in which you see Ficre. You write about that hawk and that
yep.
almost that omen of something coming. How do you understand those visions, those dreams, those things that seem to be beyond
yes.
you know, the everyday, the here and now?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that making art attunes you to is that when I make a poem, for example, I don't understand everything that I've put in it.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have made something, if I feel good about it, that has a certain clarity to it, but, you know, it's hopefully prismatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like if I wrote something for the newspaper and I wanted to be clearly understood.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be clear, but I want there to be facets to that clarity. Mm-hmm. And I am always surprised if a poem is any success. There are always things in it that I didn't know that I put in it. And what, you know, we poets have a little saying where we say the poem is smarter than the poet. You know, that's the mystery of art making. So I've always found comfort, and this is also about generations, coming out of generations of rational Black people who had to be rational and had to be practical, that I have the luxury of saying, I cannot understand all of this.
Yeah.
And that is what life is made out of. Mm-hmm. Things that we can never understand and things we strive to understand coexisting. So I think also to that end, I've always been a vivid dreamer. I've always liked to tell my dreams. I've written dream poems that are not transcribed, but they start with the amazing images. I had an image, a dream the other night, and I realized I was tired because I hadn't been dreaming so interestingly, that my friend Esther, who I mention in the book, who's my age, that she had a little teeny tiny golden baby on a necklace around her, a little beautiful baby, and I was so jealous that she had this little baby, and she said, well, let me take her off the chain and you can hold her. And she put the little baby right here, and then the dream went on to something else. And so I just felt like, well, that was a lovely, fascinating, weird thing. And I don't know where it came from, and I can't explain it. I could do something about it, you know, and sort of parse it in that way. But what I found in writing poems that began with dream imagery is that dreams took me to the strange juxtapositions of language and perception that are what makes poetry interesting. So that is all to say that the mystery, the not understanding, that the rational people, the doctors, know and don't know. You know, that a doctor told him he was healthy. You know, but and I'm not mad at that doctor, you know, and that also the doctors who tried to save him wept. How did they know? They don't weep every time, I don't think. So what was that moment for them? You know, I mean, just so many moments of human power and beauty and mystery. That another doctor, you know, New Haven's full of doctors, so I, you know, talked to all doctors to understand what happened. You know, he was a smoker, as I mentioned in in the book, and what I imagined was, oh, well, you know, smokers get cancer, check his lungs. And so, you know, I talked to all of these cardiologists, and one of them, and I said to him, I said, did you know he was a war refugee? And he said, oh, well, he said, oh, much more than the cigarettes. You know, and he said it with such authority. Someone else, a doctor, told me a story about a priest who had the same thing happen to him on the pulpit of his church, preaching Easter Sunday service, and that because it was next door to the fire department, there was someone who could immediately help him, and he was brought back and later said, you know, and we hear these stories, I saw my mother, I didn't want to come back. It was beautiful. I was on my pulpit. It was Easter. Why am I back? You know, I mean, and that's coming from, like, the doctor who's supposed to be the one who just has the facts. But he's telling me a magical story that also has a priest in it. And I don't have a church. But then, you know, but Fikre's Coptic Orthodox, he comes from a totally monolithic culture. And so, though he veered from that church, we were married in the Greek Orthodox Church in New Haven, where they married like the Black Eritreans, you know, because there's nowhere else for us to do it if we want to do it that way. And Father Peter, you know, really became a very important person to me in my not knowing what to do and seeing hundreds of his people come with a very clear idea of what you do, culturally mandated, and clear cultural practices, which I respected, but which were not often what I needed to do or what I thought my children needed to do. It's very, very demonstrative. It's very, there's keening, there's weeping, there's beating of the casket, there's you do it all over again in 40 days or else the soul doesn't go to heaven. You know, so that passage about like, here's this monolithic culture that Ficre said no to, though he didn't reject it, mm-hmm. but he didn't. And then here's this beautiful Greek priest who's my translator.
Yeah.
And who said, you know what? God can hear us wherever we are. I'll come with you and talk to the boys if you can't deal with all of that, you know, in the mm-hmm. aftermath. Mm-hmm. So I learned so much. I've learned so much, you know, about mystery and belief.
Well, you say poetic logic is my logic.
Yeah.
And that, to me, it feels like that's what you're saying here, too.
Yes.
You
know,
you don't dissect it. You don't go at it with the critic's eye.
Gotta trust it.
Yeah, gotta trust it.
Yeah.
When we first met, you had written the memoir, which is kind of a private act in a way. And as Mark Doty said to you, it's a way to fall in love all over again. You have that person, you have those moments, those memories, and they're yours. Mm-hmm. And since then, you have been on the road.
Yes,
you have been at book festivals. You've been at events like this. I've read about some of the responses. I've, of course, read the reviews. Could you have imagined, you know, the responses that you're getting from people who really, they feel like this is their book, too, in a certain way, without, you know, without destroying the particularity of your experience?
That has been amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I found, because also the other part is, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails.
Yeah.
And proper letters as well. Mm-hmm. And presents. You know, things that people have sent me and given me. Offerings that they feel connect them with the book in some way. Some of the things, one of the most powerful book events was in Los Angeles, where I did it in conjunction with a group called Inside Out Writing that makes writing groups for juveniles who are incarcerated and then continues those writing groups when they're out and as part of a support for reintegrating them. And some of those young people read with me, and some of those young people with the book just dog-eared and battered interviewed me on stage like we're being interviewed. You know, I mean, so the thing that was amazing is I would say a small fraction of the people who responded powerfully lost spouses or lost spouses at a relatively young age. Some people, yes. But, you know, there's so much loss and love and feeling and the wish to connect with it out there. And so I feel like that humanity that I've been very, very privileged and also, I wouldn't quite say chosen, but what I will say is I really feel like I was a vessel for something. And like with this book, I bore witness to a lot of things. I look back now, Simon, in that scene about, you know, and also I was so happy. I didn't realize before I was preparing how much of here, how much New Mexico is in this book. So I was happy to share that. But, you know, Simon was a little boy, and now he's a big old boy. Just 3 years later, he's a young man now. And when I read that section and I think what kind of knowing came through that child? I bear witness to it. He's not even that child anymore. He doesn't even he remembers it, but he doesn't remember it. So I feel that I feel very both fortunate and also what I feel proud of myself for is that I've practiced my craft over a lifetime. You know, I've been a devoted and serious artist without fail for my whole professional life. So that in the manner of, again, my family, my people who say, like, get ready, stay ready, be ready, you don't know what life is going to throw you, that I had craft to bring to this opportunity to bear witness that, as it turns out, has been... And one thing I'm also just kind of certain of, this is actually only the beginning of the life of this book in the world. I actually just know that because of the response I'm getting. So... Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and good. I wanted to ask you a bit about your students because your love for your students comes through in this book.
Oh.
I mean, you You call them, as you call your sons, my darlings. Mm-hmm. They seem to have enveloped you when this happened. And in fact, you went back after Fikre's sudden death. You went back the next week to teach your last class in African American art at Yale.
Yep.
And you give part of that lecture. They seem to have been necessary to you in terms of holding on, but also holding you.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that you know, one of the real privileges and joys of being a teacher mm-hmm. for decades is that, you know, the world is populated with former students. I was mm-hmm. thinking about that actually recently, about what it means that, you know, most of my students, our students, don't become literature professors, right. don't become writers, don't become critics or artists. You know, mm-hmm. they do other sorts of things. But they all carry with them what we looked at and thought about in the community that we made around those books and works of art in the classroom. Forever and ever and ever. And I really believe that classrooms are sacred space mm-hmm. for honoring community, for making community, for, and because I mostly teach African American literature and culture, sometimes in those community building conversations, there are difficult mm-hmm. moments.
Yeah.
You know, June Jordan, the poet and essayist who taught for a minute at Yale, she said, "I'm teaching black literature to the descendants of slaves and the descendants of slave owners in the same mm-hmm. space." Mm-hmm. How do we have that conversation? You know, and this is when she was teaching there in the 1970s. So I feel really, really proud of the hard work that I've done around having difficult conversations and also sharing the joy of art, the privilege of being in the world of art. In New Haven and chairing, as I did for some years, the Department of African American Studies, building community was important. And I think that that gets back to a very fundamental principle and something that I learned from writing this book and going on the road with it, that love that starts out between two people, and I heard myself saying, I said that in that inaugural poem, uh-huh. love beyond filial, love yeah. beyond national, love that casts a widening pool of light. Yeah. You start with, you know, like, you know, two people in a cafe. You come together, you make a world, you have children, you love each other. That is a precious resource that can't be hoarded. And we both believed that it needs to radiate outward. Mm-hmm. And so, too, to the community of African American studies, to the community of students present and past, who I feel belong to me and I to them. Mm-hmm. And so, an important lesson from my mother, they wanted to take care of me and I wanted to stay the mama.
Right.
So they offered to bring me food. You know, just a lot of food in the book. Mm-hmm. So, and I was like, no, I could do the. Blah, 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 blah. And my mother said, let those children feed you. Yeah. Let them feed you. And, you know, of course, as I know, and as many of you know, and as you probably know, but I didn't know it at the time, to let people help you, to let them love you. It, you know, it is a very, very important thing to do. And it's a lesson to the young people.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, of course, I had to make it bossy. You know, it's like, okay, so I need a salad and a cooked vegetable, and it can't be greasy, and it has yeah. to come at 5:30, and the kids can only have dessert once a week, you know. And so, you know, I like, boss.
Yeah.
But you know, those beautiful kids, yeah. like, they came. You know, they came, and they came proudly. And it was a beautiful thing. And my kids saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're in New York. You're back where you started. You were born in New York. You're mm-hmm. back. I'm a New Yorker. I love the city, too. I don't live there now, but I'm hoping to get back. And I wanted to end tonight by giving you a small gift. I know you have probably read E.B. White's Here Is New York, which has got to be one of the greatest.
No, I okay. have not. Yes, this is a scoop.
I was looking for a copy of it today, just in case you hadn't read it, so now I will send it to you. But it's one of the best books ever written about New York. White wrote it in, I think, 1946, and he stayed for a weekend at a hotel and was thinking about his time in the 20s in New York. And it's a lovely essay that was printed as a book called Here is New York, which you will receive shortly.
Okay.
But on the first page of Here is New York, he says this, and I thought of you. The residents of Manhattan are to a large extent strangers who've pulled up stakes somewhere and come to town seeking sanctuary or fulfillment or some greater or lesser grail. The capacity to make such dubious gifts is a mysterious quality of New York. It can destroy an individual, or it can fulfill him, depending a good deal on luck. No one should come to New York to live unless he's willing to be lucky. And I thought of your bravery in changing, in pulling up stakes, in making a new life in New York. And I just want to wish you the luck of New York, renewed joy in New York, and a measure of peace.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.